Hello, I'm Sheila Dillon, and welcome to this BBC download of the Food Programme. For information on the BBC's terms and conditions of use, visit www.bbc.co.uk/radio4. And now, enjoy the podcast. Piccolo, Marmande, Plum, Cherokee, Purple, Rosa. Once they were love apples, rare and treasured. Now they're as ubiquitous as sliced bread, and only some are worth treasuring. But some of the very best tomatoes, the South American fruit that crept slowly into our daily diet over 4.5 centuries, are now being grown in Britain. In today's programme, we're looking at how that's happened and what it means. And with me to talk about our favourite fruit is Lindsay Barham, author of The Big Red Book of Tomatoes. Lindsay, give us a quick history of the tomato. It's quite interesting, isn't it?
It is. I mean, as you've said, it's thought that it originated in South America and it grew wild and it wasn't cultivated. And then it's not quite known how it turned up in Europe, but possibly through Spain. And it took a long time for us to get onto it. I mean, I think Mrs. Beaton told us to boil it, a bit like cabbage, you know, for hours and hours. But now, of course, we eat it every day of the year. And there's been, in 1997, the British Tomato Growers Association was set up on the back of the health benefits of tomato to promote British tomatoes and lycopene as being such a good anti-cancer in particular ingredient. So we're encouraged to eat a lot of tomatoes.
And we do eat a lot of tomatoes.
Mm, we do. And since then, my book was originally published in 1999. And at the time, the big buzzword for tomatoes was grown for flavour. And, you know, which beggars the question, what else do you grow them for? And now, 10 years later, it's all about on the vine. You know, tomatoes are a vine fruit. And so we are enticed, prices are higher, by little rows of tomatoes attached to the vine.
Well, most homegrown tomatoes are grown in glass houses, handsome, some say, gigantic constructions, 6 metres high, spreading over many acres. And the epicentre of that production, growing the bulk of British tomatoes, is the Isle of Wight, one of the warmest, sunniest places in the UK. There, the biggest company is the Wight Salad Group, who also grow tomatoes in Portugal. Food writer and tomato aficionado Marlene Spilo went there for us to meet head grower Brian Morley.
These are Jack Hawkins. That tomato is it's probably 120 mils, so it's a big beef tomato.
Right, and that's, in fact, it looks like a small pumpkin. It's that big. You could stuff that and feed a family of six.
These ones are actually too big. They're really outside of our specification. So these ones will actually go off to be sold locally, farmers' markets, or we also have another company we work with that makes sauces, etc., etc. We are the only people growing it commercially in the UK and probably in the world. It's a very difficult variety to grow. It's a lovely, juicy tomato, and it's filled inside. And it's very red inside. It has very high lycopene levels.
So now we've walked into a greenhouse. It's like a parade. It's an absolute parade of tomatoes. Little round ones, little dark ones. Some are very dark green, like a green pepper. Oh, look at these. These have those ribs, and they're kind of like, well, they're green. Can I say they're green zebras? Green zebras are a treat. You eat them green and they taste sweet and tangy.
Next autumn we have their sister.
Red zebras! Oh, and the red zebras are gorgeous because instead of being striped white and green, they're striped orange and red and green. And they look so beautiful. I'd like to have furniture made out of them. They're really gorgeous. And yellow sunshine. These are cherry size, big cherry size, I'd say. And they're kind of a red, orange, dark, purplish color striped with green. Oh, wow. And we're going to get to eat some right now. When you open it, the color is like, it's like a tequila sunrise or sunset. Seeds are yellow and a green gel. And The flesh is just a beautiful red with a hint of raspberry and a little bit of orange in it.
But this variety is Piccolo, and it's a really tasty variety. It's normally sold on the vine, slightly more acid maybe than the Angel you've just eaten, but it looks good, and it's also a really nice tasting variety.
So really sweet and so juicy. Now, these remind me of a tomato that I tasted once in Italy. And actually, the chef dipped them in caramel syrup. And the caramel hardened and got all toffee-like and crisp. And then when you bit into it, it was like a bonbon. But inside, it was hot, fresh, because they didn't really cook hot, fresh tomato. And it was great.
It's not how I've eaten tomatoes before, but it sounds interesting. So, yeah, I'd like to try it, but it's not traditionally how I eat tomatoes.
These are great. Tell me about these, Brian.
This is a variety called Island Beauty, and it was named by an island resident.
Can I take a bite?
Absolutely.
Okay.
The flavour should linger in your mouth as well. It should stay there for quite some time. It's been a very successful launch. People love the name. And we're hoping great things for it.
How long have you been growing it?
This is the first year.
You're kidding. This tomato knows what it's doing. It's a beautiful tomato. I just love it.
We think it's a great success. It's been well selected. And this, along with the others that we're growing, they've all spent a lot of time trying to select the best attributes that the customer want. And we're hoping that we've got a selection of varieties now that put us at the top of the taste panel.
Well, it's really exciting to have a variety of, to have all of the, you know, the biodiversity of tomatoes coming back. Because instead of just having a tomato or a tomato salad, it's an adventure. And, you know, you can't get bored with tomatoes like this.
Marlene Spieler will be joining her again later as she cooks with some of those intriguing varieties. But actually, in the studio, Lindsay Barham has some of those intriguing varieties.
I bought this box, which is just incredible, isn't it?
It is. I mean, there's different varieties. There's I sound like Marlena, but there's a yellow pumpkin in there.
Yeah, I mean, that is...
What is
enormous.
That?
And then all these stripy ones. Heritage tomatoes are the new buzz. You know, we've had Growing for Flavour, we've had On the Vine. And the next big thing that is starting to seep into farmers' markets, discerning greengrocers, and you can buy online, and chefs are buying directly, is heritage tomatoes, so-called heritage tomatoes.
Why aren't we making more of an inroad into that 80% of tomatoes coming from Holland, from Spain, from Morocco, from all over the place?
I dare say it's because we haven't really got the right weather to be a proper tomato-growing country.
Or we have to build glasshouses to be
exactly.
Which costs
now,
a lot of money.
Now, there is this wonderful farm called Butter Villa in Cornwall, where they are getting back to basics, and they are doing as they do in Italy, which is they just cover their tomatoes, leave the sides open, and plant them.
You mean
them
like a polytunnel?
Yeah, but a kind of more casual, if you like. It's not like a
casual polytunnel.
Well, it's more like a tent, a tarpaulin with open sides so that the weather can get in and reflect. Last year, I saw the same thing going on at Secrets Farm. I went to pick asparagus, but they were growing tomatoes and they had this same arrangement.
And Secrets Farm is one of the big suppliers to chefs all over southern England.
Yeah, but doing a lot of work into producing tomatoes that really taste like tomatoes.
Well, we've now been joined by Felicity Lawrence, who's revealed more about the dark side of food production in her book, such as Not on the Label, What Really Goes Into the Food on Your Plate, and in her articles in The Guardian, than any other journalist in this country. Felicity, besides taste and freshness, as we hear from Lindsay, and flavour, what other reasons are there for a resurgence in UK tomato production?
I think one of the key issues with imports is the labour conditions and the environmental degradation that goes with some of the really big industrial production in areas such as southern Spain and southern Italy and North Africa. I visited both southern Italy and southern Spain and interviewed dozens and dozens of migrants who live in conditions of unbelievable squalor in 21st century Europe. You have to pinch yourself sometimes to remember that you are in Europe when you visit these places. They live without sanitation, often in old broken houses or just under a few rocks, really extraordinary conditions. So bad that in southern Italy, Médecins Sans Frontières, the French-based charity that usually works in refugee camps in war zones, has actually been running clinics for them in southern Italy. And in Spain, when I've looked recently, I've come across migrants who actually had been bussed straight from detention centres to the salad-growing areas, living in plastic boxes that they'd constructed without water and without sanitation. And clearly that's one of the issues that makes some of these imports cheaper than what, you know, British people behaving well can do. It's not that we don't have exploitation of migrant labour here. We certainly have had many cases of it. But I think that sort of wholesale, blatant exploitation that you get in some parts of southern Europe is not the norm here, thankfully. There's usually huge irrigation pipes for the tomatoes and the other horticultural production, but absolutely no drinking water provided for the workers. So you hear stories of people actually expiring from heat exhaustion. And that's always the worry. I mean, I think, to be fair to the British supermarkets, the big retailers are very aware of the issues around labour in southern Europe, and they do audit. And I think mostly they would source directly from large producers there who are required to meet higher labour standards than that. The difficulty always, as I've had described to me how the system works, is that you'd have a front production hothouse, which where everything would look okay, but quite often there are sort of back operations where things are not okay, and that feeds into the front operation, and it's very hard for auditors to detect that. So that is certainly part of the reason why foreign imports are often cheaper. I think the other reason is that we do try here to impose slightly higher environmental standards. The environmental degradation you find in some of these areas in around the Mediterranean, whether it's North Africa or Italy, southern Spain, is extraordinary. And there are areas of great water stress where people are growing things that require large amounts of water, and they've extracted water, so over-extracted it from the water table, that they've got huge problems with salination of the water table and water running out, and there's a lot of illegal extraction of water.
A lot of extremely good reasons to buy tomatoes grown in Great Britain. Well, a few days ago, I went to the Vale of Evesham to another giant glasshouse owned by Holt Nurseries, a family-owned company, to meet Managing Director Rowley Holt.
I mean, this is the most astonishing sight, isn't it? I mean, you look down this great avenue of tomatoes.
The glasshouse is 12 acres in size. It's 200 metres long and 255 metres wide.
It's just it's just a forest of tomatoes in lines. It's astonishing. These are more conventional-looking tomatoes. What variety are these?
This variety is Encore, which is a round tomato, which is a standard classic tomato.
A standard classic tomato that tastes good or not?
It just tastes very nice, as long as it's picked ripe.
And is that the advantage, one of the advantages you have as a British grower, in that you can pick ripe?
Yeah, definitely, because our fruit can be in the stores in 24 hours, so we can pick it that ripe, and it can be packed the same day if need be.
What medium? I mean, the plants are growing in these gutters, as you call them. What's
basically
inside?
The plants are in a little rock wall block. It's an inert medium, so it's ideal for growing smarter plants. And the plants are placed on this hanging gutter in a plastic gully. The nutrients and water is flowing by each plant. The plant takes up what nutrients it wants. So the roots are growing within this plastic gully here. There's no soil and there's no overhead irrigation.
Which means that it's a very efficient use of water.
That's
and
right.
Then do you recycle the water?
It's 100% recycled. So the plant takes up what nutrients it wants. It then goes back to a tank. It gets oxygenated, mixed up, and then is pumped back into the glasshouse.
And what's remarkable about this is that it's going to be a... It's almost a closed system, or it will be. I mean, explain how that's going to work.
Yeah, the plan is we've actually got planning permission to build an anaerobic digester right next to the glasshouse. The byproducts of the digester are biomethane, which you can then use to heat the glasshouse through a combined heat and power system. You can also produce electricity. You'll also produce CO2 from the anaerobic digester. The digestate, which is the end product after the digestion process, can then be used as liquid fertiliser on the fields nearby. So we'll be quite self-sufficient on energy.
So, I mean, there has been this argument that, in fact, growing a crop like tomatoes in the UK is, you know, really energy heavy and we'd be much better to rely on imports. But you're saying that's not true.
No, that's definitely not the case, because all growers in the UK have to look at energy now because it's becoming more expensive to use fossil fuels. So we're all looking at renewable ways of heating glasshouses. So if you don't look at energy now, you won't be in business in probably 5 to 10 years' time.
I'm Phil Morley, Technical Officer at the British Tomato Growers Association.
Could we produce, Phil, a lot more tomatoes in the UK?
We could certainly produce a lot more if we had the extra area to produce in. We need more glasshouses in the UK.
The government is saying that, you know, we now have to go back to an economy where we produce things. Isn't there, therefore, a sort of impetus to help people build glasshouses, grow our own food?
That's a really good point, and it's absolutely true that we should be producing more in this country. At the moment, there doesn't seem to be a huge appetite from government to support UK horticulture in that way financially. So it's up to growers to invest their own private money in developing partnerships to build and expand their own production areas in the UK.
So, Rolly, I mean, this magnificent thing that we're standing in, this glasshouse development, I mean, how much did this cost?
It cost about £5 million from the very beginning, which involved planning.
And was it easy to get planning permission?
No, it wasn't. It took 3 years.
Why?
Well, there's a lot of hurdles to go through. Although we're in the Vale of Evesham, which is a horticultural area, there was a lot of objection to the idea of a glasshouse being built in this area. So it just took a long time.
No, I mean, you pride yourself on the varieties that you grow that are full of taste. I mean, where does taste in a tomato come from?
Taste in a tomato is a very complex thing, how the different varieties create their flavours, the volatiles, and really that's down to variety. As long as you give a tomato plant exactly what it wants at the root, so the nutrition is correct, and a plant in soil will take up the nutrients it needs. In soil it's slightly different, of course, because it has an interaction with biological factors of soil as well. In these systems, the plants are given everything they need, and the plants turn the components within themselves into the complex flavour principles that give different tomato varieties their characteristic flavour and their characteristic aromas as well.
Rolly, what do you feel about the role that supermarkets play in your industry?
Well, our industry is, to an extent, supermarket driven.
And is it a relationship that you think is a fair one?
Well, I obviously, being the grower, I wouldn't say that, but certainly there are supermarkets who do support British growers a lot, and without their support, we wouldn't have the courage and we wouldn't consider expanding and trying to improve our industry.
Do you feel you get a fair price for your tomatoes?
I guess you have to look historically. The price of tomatoes hasn't really changed in 10 years, yet the inputs are always increasing, the labour costs, the energy costs. So the only way we can continue to stay in business is to be efficient on all of these inputs. So, of course, being the grower, the price should reflect the increased inputs. And there comes a point when you can't get your overheads down any further. So the price, it has to go up in the future for us to stay in business.
Well, Felicity Lawrence and Lindsay Barham are still with me in the studio. It's a bit stunning, don't you think, that supermarkets are still paying growers what they were 10 years ago, Felicity?
It's very hard to see how they can survive if that's the case. I mean, their costs have gone up enormously in terms of, as the interviewee said, of fuel and energy generally, cost of fertiliser and so on. And one fears if that's the case, that people are driven to cut corners or driven out of business. That, I suppose, is the pattern right across the agricultural sector, isn't it, that you have to have all these mergers and acquisitions and get bigger and bigger in order to have the efficiencies and to be able to stand up in terms of negotiating with supermarkets. But the smaller growers, local growers, disappear.
But you could say, Felicity, couldn't you, that, you know, the supermarket sort of flatlining on price has forced these growers into these amazing environmental revolutionary changes. You know, as we heard Rolly Holt saying, you know, they're going to have a completely closed system when they've built their anaerobic biodigester. I mean, they will be using almost no fossil fuels, and their water consumption is pretty zero because it's completely a recycled system. You know, you could say, by being so mean, supermarkets have forced these changes, which are environmentally extremely advantageous.
I think that the supermarkets have actually pushed on environmental changes and water changes for all sorts of reasons, and it's not that's not just about economics, although it contributes, but I think they can see very clearly that farming is not going to be sustainable and that they need to help people do that. The worry is that it goes too far and that you see what you've seen in the, say, for example, the dairy sector, where actually we just haven't got enough production anymore. And I think that's the real worry, where you see this shrinking of the UK agricultural base just at the point that we want to make sure these people survive.
I mean, one of the other, I think, really heartening things about tomato production in the UK and glasshouse production generally is that most UK producers are now using biological controls and not pesticides in a way that is really sort of leading edge stuff. And you don't quite see that, I think, in Southern Europe or in North Africa.
I think they're beginning to move in that direction. And I think, again, to be fair to the supermarkets, they're driving some of that. But you do still see very, very heavy use of agrochemicals.
Well, let's end on the pleasure of tomatoes after we've considered all these depressing labour issues and other environmental problems in the 80% of tomatoes that we import. You've been doing some cooking, Lindsay, and you've put out little canapé kind of things. What have you done with these tomatoes, and what are the tomatoes?
These are a tomato called Jester, which is like a small, medium-sized plum, which I think has quite a good flavour. But you could use any tomato you like for this, and you could make your little... These are just circles of puff pastry that I've just cooked until they're crusty. And I've made some pesto, and just... You know, it's the perfect thing. You could make this a family-sized tart or individual tarts or just little nibbly ones like this. So it's just puff pastry, pesto and a slice of tomato on the top.
Now, you have to give one of these to Felicity, because Felicity's been coming on this programme for years talking about really serious things, and nobody's ever offered her anything to eat.
No. Mm. It's so simple, isn't it?
But it only works because the flavours are so intense. Mm. Oh, it's delicious.
And now the other one that you've done?
This is a Moroccan idea, and it's slowly roasting elongated sort of plum-type tomatoes for nearly 2 hours with a seasoning of orange flour, water, cinnamon and a little bit of oil and some sugar, just roasting them like that until they kind of shrivel up, but they still remain moist and juicy, and then they've just got some chopped... quickly fried almonds on the top. And it's a sweet meat.
It is a sweet meat.
So this is showing how the tomato can be served as a sweet thing.
That's lovely. And what's that stuff? There's some sort of pale orange paste in a jar.
Well, this is my latest fad, which is you halve some tomatoes, any old tomatoes you like, or quarter them, medium-sized vine tomatoes would be best. Put them in a pan with, in this instance, I added the juice of an orange and a little bit of orange zest and a little bit of honey and a little bit of saffron, and covered the pan and cooked it for about 40 minutes until everything is completely squashy. And then you force it all through a sieve, scraping underneath so that you don't waste any. And then you put it back in the pan, and you could serve it at that point as a soup. Really delicious. Or you go on simmering, and you can, you know, you can tailor it to what you want. You can have a sauce for your pasta, or you can end up with this. It's kind it's of like a jam. Mm. Which you can have with scones or, you know.
How long would you have cooked that for, down to a jam?
Well, it depends how quickly you do it. I was terrified that I was going to burn it, but you could actually bubble it away quite vigorously, so it could be about half an hour.
Amazing. Well, thank you both very much, Lindsay Barham and Felicity Lawrence. Let's give the last word to Marlena Spieler, who, after her tour of the glass houses on the Isle of Wight, took some of the best varieties to a nearby kitchen. There, she conjured up a dish combining fresh ginger with tomatoes and then produced something zinging to put on your pasta.
OK, well, we've got our tomatoes roasting in the oven and we're going to make a pasta sauce. And we're going to have a selection of tomatoes. The best tomatoes for a really refreshing tomato sauce, are the little cherry tomatoes, the tiny little tomatoes that are full of flavor. And I like to balance that off a little bit with something that has a little bit more body, a little San Marzano maybe, a little bit. We have Marmande, which is just great because that's got a really nice balance of tangy and sweet. So we've got a selection. I threw a few green zebras in there. So we've got a nice selection of sweet and body. And we're going to start off by sautéing a little bit of red onion, nice sweet onion, and quite a bit of garlic, some hot peppers. You can smell the olive oil. You can hear the onion sizzling as I add the garlic. And you don't want them to burn. You don't even want them to brown. You just want them to sizzle a bit. Speaking of sizzling, I threw quite a nice little handful of dried chili flakes in. So this is going to be spicy. We're going spicy here. And I'll throw a few leaves of basil in, just because that's the way they do it in the old country. And we're going to throw in some white wine. And we're going to let the wine all cook down to where the alcohol is pretty much all evaporated. So I'm thinking that we're ready to go ahead and throw in our tomatoes. So here we go with the chopped Marmande and the red beauties. And here we go with the little cherry tomatoes are all cut in half because I don't want them to cook too much. I want them to really keep their integrity. If you look at this, it's like a mosaic of different kinds of tomatoes. There's little bits of Marmande, little bits of Island Beauty, little bits of Red Delicious, little bits of Piccolo. There's something for everyone tomato-wise in this sauce, and we're just going to let it cook on a very high heat, about 5-10 minutes.
Marlena Spieler, and all her recipes as well as Lindsay's, and the details of Felicity's books can be found on our website at bbc.co.uk/radio4/foodprogramme.